We're ready to move forward to the third matter on our oral argument calendar today. And counsel, I appreciate you coming forward to settle yourselves in, take whatever time you need to do that, and arrange your papers. I'll ask the marshal to call the third case.
19-0448, Charles Edward Conkey, petitioner, appellant, versus Jennifer Wodak Conkey, respondent.
All right, and counsel, I'll just make a few quick remarks. You're probably familiar with all of these things, but just in case you need a moment to catch your breath, when you get up to the podium, make sure you take whatever time you need to adjust it. So that means the microphone near your mouth as well as the height of the lectern. And then please identify yourself for the record. So that means tell us who you are as well as the client that you represent. Our proceedings are recorded today, and so that keeps our recording really clear. So with that, you can proceed, counsel for appellant.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Joni Moberg, and I represent the appellant in this matter, whose name is Charles Honkey. I acknowledge today that we're here on a spousal maintenance modification review, which you look at under an abusive discretion standard. So the question presented simply are the findings here supported by the record? Has there been a misapplication of the law? And or are any of the district court's findings contrary to logic and the facts on the record? Appellant in this case admits that there are five key areas in which the district court abused its discretion under these questions. And those areas are, first of all, whether the district court correctly determined wife's budget at the time of the spousal maintenance modification. Essentially, the district court here declined to make any new findings about wife's budget, instead deferring to the budget that the court had determined under the dissolution judgment and decree. And this error is compounded by a second error, which is the court's acceptance of husband's voluntarily reduced budget while declining to look at wife's. The third area of concern is the findings with regard to husband's bonus income. He had new employment, so whereas the parties had previously relied on a five-year average over a historically very long period of bonus receipt, the court had no information about any bonuses received under his new employment. The fourth category is the issue of gift income and whether the court correctly determined that it was precluded from looking at whether there had been a change of circumstances such that a different treatment of gifts received by wife after the divorce was warranted. And finally, and perhaps the most complicated, is the issue of whether and how the court should consider an obligation acquisition of assets after the divorce in looking at a spousal maintenance modification case. Any of those five errors I would submit are significant and standing alone could warrant reversal and should warrant reversal of the district court's decision. I'll start with the fifth one that I just noted, which is consideration of assets acquired after the divorce. The statute indicates that the court, in determining whether spousal maintenance should be modified, must consider income from marital property and post-dissolution resources. So that's what the case law has said. That's what the statute says. The statute specifically talks about resources, not income, and that distinction is important and should be given importance in interpretation.
In your view, is it wife's position that the cash gifts, first of all, are not income, but also are not an asset? They're nothing, essentially. Is that how you perceive their argument?
They can certainly address that themselves, Your Honor, but I believe that there's not any significant dispute of the fact that income from those gifts could be considered, but it's the extent to which the principal should be considered that I believe is the most significant dispute. And I would submit on that issue that there's the main legal error here is that the district court, as I read the decision, interprets case law and statute as indicating the corpus, the principle of assets acquired after a divorce can never be considered, that's precluded under the law. And that's a very important distinction from the court having decided they can be considered, and I just declined to do so. That would be more consistent with the discretion the district court has. It's not our position that they must be considered, and those are three very different points. It's our position that they can be considered.
Well, if they can be considered, then why isn't the district, in an abuse of discretion standard, why isn't the district court's action with regard to the, I think the district court called the legacy gifts, that wasn't about $500,000 that she received?
Correct.
Between the judgment decree and the decision. I mean, then why isn't that appropriate? I mean,
I want to make sure I'm understanding your question. Is your question, if the court had determined that it could consider them, could it be confirmed because it didn't consider them and there's a basis for not doing so?
I thought you agreed that the district court has discretion with these sorts of gifts. It wasn't required to consider them, but it wasn't required to not consider them. There's discretion.
I agree with that, Your Honor, but my interpretation of the district court's order is that the court felt like it was precluded from considering them and never engaged in any discussion about whether it was appropriate to consider them. And that is a reversible misstatement of the law. Here, there's two errors, two that compound one another, because our position, as we argued this to the district court, is we gave alternatives. Either amortize it, so look at spending down that post-decree acquisition of wealth, which is consistent with the Weiner decision, or you have to look at her budget, because you can't have it both ways. If she's not required to invade that $550,000+ of tax-free gifts she received, then she certainly no longer has the need for a significant line item in her budget for ongoing retirement savings.
The Weiner decision, it seems to me, is very different than this case. I mean, one, it is an unpublished decision, I understand, and you have acknowledged that. I mean, but it was dealing with kind of assets that were marital assets that were divided, right? And then what, 20 years later, we're dealing with the how those should be used?
I agree with you that there are distinctions. The big distinction I would say is that in Weiner, they were addressing retirement assets and not gifts. I would acknowledge that's a distinction, and that's an area where the court could look at different kinds of assets and determine that they warrant different treatment. However, the facts in Weiner really aren't that different. Our position is that the issue here is what happens when a spouse acquires significant assets after the divorce. And in Weiner, the court clearly distinguished between the corpus of what was awarded to wife in the divorce versus the gain on that. And the gain on that is assets acquired after the divorce. And the court determined not only that wife in that case should be expected to spend down the gain, which is assets acquired after the divorce, but went so far as to say that should have been acquired after the divorce, imposing a reasonable investment standard on wife and saying even if you don't have those assets, we still consider that you should have and you should be required to spend those down before we consider whether you have an ongoing need for spousal maintenance. That decision in Weiner is consistent with the Supreme Court decision in Lee, which determines that post-IRA is available, an IRA that was inherited and acquired after a divorce was available to pay child support. That decision is also consistent with the opinion in Lee talks about non-marital pension being available to pay support, so any pension attributable to before and after the marriage, and I misspoke, it's Benson v. Peterson that talks about that post-IRA.
Isn't the Lee case about, amount that of a new asset that can be counted as income, right, as opposed to an asset, some new source of, as you say, the statute, we have to consider the statute resources.
Correct. And Lee is certainly distinguishable. Your Honors, I submit there's no case that's directly on point to this issue. I think it's very interesting. I think you're charged today with deciding what the statute means, and I go back to my position that if the legislature intended that only income was to be considered, it would have used that word income. The Lee case and the Benson case and the Weiner case are only helpful because they at least hint at the fact that that the respondent's position in this case is not the way this court has perceived the law, and again, not consistent with the legislature. Back to your question, Judge Bryan. The Lee case is certainly distinguishable because it's talking about the obligor and not the obligee. So it's talking about what income can be considered for the obligor when it's determining whether he has the ability to continue to pay spousal maintenance when he has sought modification. And it's a pension, not a defined contribution plan, something that Judge Stetson brings up in the concurrence.
And as I read it, it doesn't allow invasion of the initial pension. It only allows you to look at the new benefits and kind of draws a line, a pretty firm line, that in some ways you could argue is inconsistent with Weiner in terms of the principle and whether you can require invasion of the principle.
Well,
again, the asset that was initially divided in Lee is one that was divided at the time of the dissolution, and then there's a new benefit that that Lee allows.
The challenge in Lee is, again, that it's a pension. So it's different than what's being talked about in Weiner, which is defined contribution and more definable, almost like a checking account. We know what money is in there. Whereas pensions are more amorphous by definition. So all we
Which are both very different than an inheritance.
Correct. But that's why it's significant that in the Benson B. Peterson case, an IRA, which was inherited and more like a gift, was required to be used for the obligor to pay child support.
Is there evidence in this record that suggests that the legacy gifts were, I mean, there's some discussion about how it was spent to pay for a wedding. Is there some evidence that would suggest that this was kind of a pass-through and that it was a gift intended for the benefit of the grandchild to pay for the grandchild's wedding?
There's no evidence of that, Your Honor. Instead, the gift testimony at trial, as you've read, was very forceful. The respondent's father testified, "I will not give any money to my daughter."
I guess I'm talking about the post-dissolution.
There's no evidence to that effect. There was some suggestion I had to pay it back to my parents for attorney's fees, and I have these other household expenses and for my daughter's wedding that I paid. However, they're both parents of that daughter, so they presumably both had expenses that they paid for that wedding. She had house gifts in her budget, and the payback to her parents for the loan for attorney's fees conveniently happened well after she'd received the gifts and after he brought this motion and served discovery.
All right, well, let me ask, sorry, go ahead.
If I could just, with the time, understood, asking about the collateral estoppel language,
yes,
the district court did. So that the district court, I think it was in 59, kind of said, you know, collateral estoppel prohibits relitigation of these issues and then talks about the gifts. At least the annual, and I see there's a difference, tell me if you disagree, between the annual gifts that they had received before the separation and then perhaps after, and the legacy gifts.
It seems like, again, I want to point out there really is no such thing as legacy gifts. It's something that is a term that the respondent in this case has kind of concocted.
And that the district court, in its findings, said that the talks about irregular legacy gifts.
Right, but the court adopted that from a term that respondent created too. I'm not aware that there's any legal definition for what a legacy gift is. Is there a difference between the regular recurring maximum annual gifts and those larger gifts?
And I think I have your answer to that based upon what we've just discussed. My question is more on the use of collateral estoppel, mm-hmm, which as you point out, if you look at the Lou versus Lou case.
I think Lou, yeah, we'll
Lou versus
that.
Lou, says that, well, you know, res judicata doesn't really quite fit when it comes to these family law cases. And the footnote says, but rather the question was one of finality of judgments. So if we agree with you that, you know, the district court here just applied collateral estoppel and said, so I'm not going to look at that again. This just happened, you know, a year and a half ago, something like that. And we say, well, collateral estoppel doesn't really apply here. Do we have to send this back? Is that something we can look at? What's your position on that?
I think that the whole case is so interconnected. Again, the fact that there are five significant areas, it's like threads that you tug on. If you agree with four of my arguments, but not one, or three, but not two, there's so many, it's kind of a choose-your-own-adventure. It's hard for me to say on that issue what you should do with it. But I will just agree with you and indicate that spousal maintenance modification is by nature It's not collateral estoppel. It's written into the statute. We all know as family law practitioners, if there's a change of circumstances, it can be looked at. I'm particularly troubled by this issue. I was there in court when the respondent's father made that very impactful testimony. And I just am very concerned about the precedent that this sets, that any person could come into court, testify like that, and the court would say, I have to believe it, and then that's a carte blanche for them to give gifts as much as they want.
I understand what you're saying. I'm also concerned, and maybe you could address this for me, with setting some sort of precedent that, you know, I think it was, 13 months after this judgment decree became final, your client filed a motion to modify spousal maintenance and saying, well, things have changed. And do we have to, then retry, spousal maintenance and budgets, every 13 months, which I think also gets to the district court's decision to say, look, she said her budget hasn't changed. And this was only a short period ago. I'm not going to go and look at this in detail.
So I know respondent has also been very troubled about how quickly this motion was brought. And there's kind of a suggestion that it's litigiousness. Mr. Hunke did not want to lose his job of 20-plus years. That was not what he anticipated. And if not for losing that job, he never would have known about the gifts. To your point about the budget, I've seen case law where a judge said, I have good reasons for why I think nothing has changed, but there are a couple areas where I'm going to change it. Here, the district court specifically expressed skepticism about some areas of the respondent's budget, her need for ongoing retirement savings in light of these gifts. It didn't seem to be disputed she was not currently incurring therapy costs. And there's discussion in the judge's order about the fact that she's continuing to pay for more expensive COBRA, despite having taken a job that she said she specifically took a pay cut for because it offered health benefits. So those three categories alone are categories the court should have looked at. Did we want another three-day trial exhaustively exploring Quicken? I can speak for myself and say I don't want to do that again. But I would submit the court didn't have to do that here, and she still could have fulfilled her obligation under the statute of looking at this issue. I see that my time is up, so if there are no further questions, I'll take a seat.
And counsel, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, Michael Boulette here on behalf of respondent and cross-appellant Jennifer Hongi. Your Honor, in 2016, these parties divorced, and everybody agreed this was a permanent spousal maintenance case. In 2018, Mr. Hongi returned to court and said, I want to be done paying spousal maintenance. I think we're finished here. The district court declined that invitation, and it did so appropriately. And despite conducting its analysis correctly, almost to the end, it made one final mistake, which is a mistake that's perhaps forgivable because it didn't have this court's decision in Madden versus Madden. It incorrectly calculated Ms. Honke's resources for the purposes of calculating her need for spousal maintenance. I want to start first as respondent rather than as cross-appellant and talk about the suggestions that have been made by counsel that really here we have a completely uncharted area of the law. We truly don't. Counsel is absolutely correct that 518.552 asks the district court to consider a spousal maintenance recipient's financial resources for meeting her needs, and that includes her property, including the marital property allocated to her. That is not an uninterpreted phrase. It's not a phrase that this court and the Supreme Court haven't had a chance to consider. For the better part of 40 years, the Supreme Court has looked at that exact language, financial resources available to meet needs, and has said it's income. It's income and it's only ever income. And so we trace the development of this case law at the Supreme Court level from Brahms to Erlinson to to Nardini to Lyons, all the way to Curtis in 2016. And at each step of the analysis, the Supreme Court is very careful to say what we look at when we consider a recipient's financial resources is her income. We do not ask her to spend down the corpus of her assets, regardless of whether those assets are designated as marital or, as in Erlinson, whether they're designated as non-marital. It's an irrelevant distinction. Maintenance recipients, we know from Lyon, can never accumulate an estate from the maintenance they receive. Ms. Honke doesn't receive a dime of spousal maintenance that she is ever able to use to accumulate an estate. She is limited indefinitely to the marital standard of living, unlike Mr. Honke. As reparations for that, we don't expect maintenance recipients to spend down to liquidate their estates and place themselves further at risk to remove a maintenance obligation.
So, if I may, Mr. Boulay, so when we're talking about assets that someone gets after the judgment decree, and we're in the special maintenance context, are you aware of cases that deal with those where they're not marital property, and they're not property that the court in that previous proceeding has says is non-marital property, kind of separate property someone had before?
I'm not aware of any of those cases. Counsel is an excellent attorney. We also looked very hard.
So
we could find none. So I am confident in saying if neither of us have located them, they don't likely exist.
So there's nothing that is specific here that deals with whether this should be limited only to income as opposed to assets, because we haven't had this sort of asset dealt with in our appellate case law. Is that fair to say?
I think that the first part of your statement is fair to say, which is that you haven't dealt with it in this specific issue in appellate case law. I don't think it matters, Judge Jessen. Here's why I don't think it matters. Because when you're applying the statute, 518-552, you're applying precisely the same statute at the time of divorce and in any post-decree modification. And so you're using the same term from the statute, financial resources, at both periods of time. If financial resources means income and only income at the time of divorce, it has to continue to mean income and only income in a post-decree setting. There is no basis in statute to try to create the distinction that counsel urges, which is, well, when they're after acquired assets, now we have to somehow look at those differently. They all have to be treated as financial resources, and they all have to follow precisely the same rules the Supreme Court has laid out as looking to income and not to assets. And so you're absolutely correct that the Curtis Court, for instance, says that the Curtis Court, for instance, is dealing with a situation in which we are at the time of divorce and looking at the income that can be earned from assets. But the prohibition enunciated in Curtis, we do not expect maintenance recipients to spend down their assets, is unequivocal, and it applies equally in a post-decree as well as in a divorce context, precisely because the court's employing the same statute.
So if we follow this logic, then why wasn't it perfectly appropriate for the district court to say, okay, I'm not going to make your client spin down that, you know, $500,000 of new assets? I understand she spent it on other things. But I'm going to kind of impute the income from it, because this is what we should be doing. We're looking at income.
You're absolutely right, Your Honor. And the court got it halfway right, right? The district court was right to say, we only look at income, and I'm going to look at the income her gifts can earn. The mistake the district court made is that it used income from assets she no longer has rather than income from the assets that she has. So Ms. Honke now has $126,000 left of those $500,000 gifts. There is no dispute from respondent below or here that the income from that additional $126,000, fair game. Impute that income to her, absolutely.
Why isn't it proper for the district court to, and I'll use the word impute. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a hypothetical investment, right? Or require a reasonable investment standard for newly acquired assets. Why is that improper when at the time of dissolution, to determine spousal maintenance, that's exactly what the district courts do all the time. They say, this is your part of the marital estate. If you invest it properly, this is what you could basically expect. And if you're getting that, then this is the gap that is filled by spousal maintenance. So why isn't it proper on a modification motion to essentially do the same thing with newly acquired assets?
It's not improper, Judge Bryan. And so to the last part of your question, I agree with you. And in a divorce setting, as in a post-decree setting, we look at the assets that you have, we impute a rate of return to them, and we say that's your income. What we don't do, and we don't do it at the time of divorce, and we don't do it post-decree, is imagine that you have assets that you don't have and impute income to those assets. I am not aware of any case at the
but
district.
Did she have the gifts at some point?
She had them at some point. She didn't have them at the time the court decided the motion. In the same way that if you tried a divorce case in 2019, The fact that you may have had assets in 2015 is irrelevant to what you can earn from your assets today. And it goes to this court's observations in Madden about the nature of the maintenance obligation here, the fact that it's a permanent obligation with no step down or expectation of further rehabilitation, and the reality that there is no obligation by a permanent maintenance recipient to invest every penny she receives from inheritance, from gifts, to reduce her former spouse's obligation. Madden, in fact, hits precisely this issue by...
What if she wins the lottery? $300 million Powerball winner, still permanent forever, spousal maintenance. You can't look at that. You can only look at actual income from an investment of that actual money. You can't invade that as a newly acquired asset?
You can't invade it as a newly acquired asset, Jay Brian. The idea that you can, whether it's $300 million or $3,000, now at $300 million, I suspect we wouldn't be here. At $300 million, it can be a 0.5% rate of return, and the reality is her need for maintenance is met. But the same principle applies, which is that the Supreme Court has looked at this phrase, what is a financial resource? And at every step of the way, it said it is income. Now, counsel points out other states have taken different approaches. Wisconsin believes that it is completely appropriate for a maintenance recipient to have to spend down after acquired assets. That is not the approach that Minnesota has taken. It has never asked a maintenance recipient to spend down her assets. The district court didn't err by declining to do that here. Where it did err, to your point, is in looking to the assets that aren't there, and we'd submit that that is particularly inappropriate here, where Ms. Honke really had no other choice. It would be one thing to the unpublished cases that counsel cites, like Maxwell. Ms. Honke had gone out and bought herself a vacation at Tahiti and a brand new Ferrari, and she'd really lived it up with her advanced inheritance. But that's not what she did.
Right, there has to be some way not to incentivize waste.
She paid her attorney's fees, an obligation she had under the divorce decree. She repaired her house. Now, counsel points out she had a repair item in her budget. That's true, she did. And it wouldn't have met a fraction of the new roof and the new paint that were needed just to maintain the marital home, to keep the same standard of living the district court found reasonable just a couple years earlier. And as to the daughter's wedding, which is a fraction of the spending here, so it is by far the biggest moving item, but that's an item that was agreed to with Mr. Honke. You pay half, I'll pay half. Now, Mr. Honke may be right, he doesn't have control over how his former spouse spends her inheritance, but when he incentivizes her to spend it in a certain way, when he says to her, I'll split the cost with you, it seems disingenuous to then come back and suggest that that was wrong of her and we should impute income to how that money was spent. So I'm not suggesting that the court needs to draw a bright line rule that says if you go out, receive an inheritance, and then blow it immediately on the most frivolous things you can think of, that can never, ever be considered. What I am saying is where the record here shows that you met your legal obligations to pay your attorneys as enunciated in the decree, you repaired the same home you've lived in for over a decade, the same home that was the marital standard of living, and you split an expense for a child agreed to with your former spouse, we don't get to impute that income back to you as part of an analysis. We have to take your investment income, just as this court says in Madden, as we find it at the time.
Shouldn't the district court have discretion to figure, obviously within some reasonable bounds, to figure out the timing about what assets she has at the, from your perspective, at the time of the motion? Is that, you know, a motion here, I think, wasn't it September or October of a year that a motion was originally brought, and then there was some discovery, and then the motion was changed, and then there was a hearing. At what, shouldn't the district court have some flexibility about saying, yes, at the relevant time, she had this money?
I don't disagree, and I think that so many of these maintenance motions have to provide flexibility. So there's no disagreement there. Where I would push back a bit on that sentiment, Judge Jessen, is flexibility within limits of fairness for both parties. So the point that this court reached in Madden that was so key is we don't impose post hoc obligations on people that they didn't know they needed to be aware of. We don't tell people, we're going to punish you for not going and getting a job when I didn't tell you you needed to go get a job earning this amount of money. Likewise, we're not going to punish you for not investing all of your inheritance when A, you spent it in ways you were required to, and B, you weren't put on notice that you needed to do that. The key unfairness that this court pinpointed in Madden is creating an expectation for a permanent maintenance recipient who bears no obligation post-decree, to reduce her need for maintenance, to go out and find a better job, to improve her wage, to reduce her need in any way, to create that obligation once litigation is renewed. People have a right to know well in advance. And because of it, and I think this is key in my final 2 minutes, because of the nature of a permanent maintenance obligation, it's easy to think that the only difference between a temporary maintenance obligation and a permanent maintenance obligation is how long it goes for. But this court's case law, reaching all the way back to Borchert, makes really clear that there are broader equities at stake. And in fact, Madden echoes many of those same equities just this past year. When a court awards permanent maintenance, and here there was no dispute, it's a long-term marriage. Ms. Honke stayed at home. She supported her husband's career. She raised three wonderful kids. She did everything that was asked of her out of the marriage deal. When we award permanent maintenance in those circumstances, we're talking about more than just a duration. We're talking about a compensatory award for human capital, for an investment in an economic future that's now gone, that she can't ever get back. And so we don't penalize permanent maintenance recipients in the way that we might in other contexts. So the Hecker decision from the Supreme Court explicitly ties the imputation of income, to your point, Judge Bryan, to the notion that you have an obligation to reduce your need for maintenance when you have a temporary award. In Madden, this court called out the notion that where we impose step-downs on you, when we say you need to go back and do better, then you really need to go back and do better. But when a permanent award without step-downs, without further obligation is implemented, what a court can't do after the fact is come in and second-guess the decisions a permanent maintenance recipient makes. Because what that does is it puts her at a fundamental disadvantage of not knowing what's going to be expected of her when she walks back through the courtroom doors, being able to be hailed there at any point in time by a former spouse, and having every financial decision she's made subject to scrutiny. Now, this court recently decided a case called Welch, which is unpublished, but I think is really key, because when you looked at that case, it was all about budgets. And when our maintenance recipient says, I don't want to go back to work, I'll just slice my budget, can we punish her for that decision later on by cutting her maintenance further and further? And the point that you made that I think is so key and echoes here is we have to provide maintenance recipients flexibility too. It's absolutely true. District courts have to retain some amount of discretion. But maintenance recipients have to structure their lives, their new and very different circumstances, around the place that we put them after the end of a long-term marriage. And we need to provide permanent maintenance recipients especially with some flexibility in how they do that, to reallocate money between budget categories as their circumstances change, to make decisions about how they pay bills and meet major expenses and are able to fund their legal obligations. And when we don't do that, we do them a disservice.
So if, from your perspective, maintenance, we need to give flexibility to permanent maintenance recipients. And I think you agreed with me that we need to give district courts some flexibility in dealing with the timing issue. So if we, and I'm not saying we would, if we agree with you on this point, shouldn't we have been sending it back to the district judge to look at the timing, more specifically at the timing issue in conjunction when the spending happened?
And that is, in fact, our position in our cross appeal, is that if the court isn't simply going to reinstate the maintenance award, that a remand is the most appropriate to decide the actual amount of the gifts that should be subject to income attribution. My time has expired. Thank you.
Okay, so, and counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. I'd like to talk about Madden. That case is distinguishable. That was a case where Mr. Boulette is correct. The recipient there had no notice that there was any expectation she earned money. She not only wasn't told she needed to increase her income, she wasn't imputed any income at all. This case is different because Ms. Honke was imputed income, and the court didn't say, I didn't tell you this before, but I expected you to go out and increase your income, and even though you haven't done those things, I'm going to impute that increased income to you, because that's what happened in Madden. Not only did I expect you to get a job, but you didn't get that minimum job, and by now that minimum job should have turned into a maximum job, and I'm imputing the maximum to you. This is not about that at all. Ms. Honke did get a job. She had a job making, she had a part-time job, even though the court told her she could work full-time, and that part-time job had an hourly rate. She decided to go full-time, and reduce her rate, working for a friend, with reasons for that that the district court did not find credible. So Madden says you can't say what they could be making if they'd done these things you didn't tell them to do. You have to find what they're capable of making now, and that's exactly what the district court did in this case. She made credibility determinations and said, based on the information I have, I believe you are currently, without making any changes or going back in time and changing anything, capable of making this level of income. So that's permissible under Madden.
Isn't there a difference between expectations related to the income she makes in a job versus getting from her perspective, unexpected gift? And how to spend that money?
There absolutely is. We're just addressing the issue that the respondent has raised, which is that the court improperly imputed employment income to her. And they're using the Madden case to argue that, and I would submit that's a misapplication of Madden. Mr. Boulette indicated that when the question was asked, what are financial resources, every step of the way this court has said it's income. That's simply not true. Weiner said you can spend your assets that you have or should have acquired after the divorce to meet your support. And when those are spent down, which they may be, we'll reserve spousal maintenance and you can come back and tell us that you need more. So that is a case where this court absolutely found that it wasn't just income. Talking about the Maxwell case, Ms. Maxwell thought that she was prudently managing her resources. She downsized one house and used that income to buy a second, and the court said, no, that's not what we had in mind. So that case is different from this case. Here, Mr. Boulette argues Ms. Maxwell was wasteful and Ms. Honke is not. The fee issues, Your Honor, that's the biggest thing she said she spent this money on. Every step of the way, every time we entered the courtroom, the judges in this case have been aghast at the fees. And she's spent more than my client, more than twice as much as my client. And that's been noted. She had hundreds of thousands of dollars of fees that were owed at the time of the divorce that had not been paid. As I recall, $200,000. And she asked for fees, and they were denied. Or she didn't ask for fees. There was a little bit of both. At the time of the judgment and decree when they settled property, they agreed they were each paying their own fees, and then there was a subsequent fee request. Either way, that issue has been litigated. I assure you, my client has paid a lot in attorney's fees, and the amount of money he has available to invest is not what we talked about in the judgment and decree. But he hasn't come back and said, I need you to reduce my investment income because I spent these assets on attorney's fees, because he knows that issue has been decided and he can't raise it now. The issues of the house and the wedding are minor, Your Honor.
Ms. Mobley, I see your time's about running out. I do think it would be important if you want to address your client's job change and the appellate issue that's raised there.
Sure.
I think as a district court judge, sometimes spousal maintenance is, in a way, guesswork. You're making assumptions about things, and I think if you could respond to the argument that a lack of history of bonus compensation by itself can't block or can't automatically result in suspension of spousal maintenance.
Well,
there has to be some way. Don't you think that the district court can address job changes and a lack of history of bonus compensation at a new employment?
Of course, and we offered that solution to the district court. That's typical. I mean, it's very unusual. I've been practicing family law for 20 years. It's very unusual for a court to say the income is this and order a flat spousal maintenance amount based on anticipated bonus income. But here, the extraordinary thing is we had such a lengthy bonus history that the party stipulated by agreement that there could be a 5-year average, and they came up with the $50,000-something amount. That changed when he changed jobs to a completely different organization with a 15% salary decrease and no expectation or understanding whatsoever about what he could expect for a bonus. It could have been anywhere from $0 to $60,000. And we all know that I think it's just logic, and that goes to the abuse of discretion issue. This is by definition uncertain at this point. He doesn't know what he's going to get. So the solution, Your Honor, which is what we do in almost every case, is to order a second tier of spousal maintenance. And we did not think that Ms. Honke demonstrated a need, but we told the district court that if she did, please at least break whatever's not covered by his salary into a second tier of spousal maintenance that can be paid only if he actually gets the bonus. So typically it's a second tier of spousal maintenance that's half of the bonus up to a cap.
I think I could spend all day with the two of you talking about family law issues, but I do have a follow-up regarding the base salary, even without the plus a percentage with a cap. But I do want to defer to the presiding judge before I presume to ask another question since your time has expired.
No, go ahead, Judge Brad.
Okay. Yeah. There is an argument that any error regarding husband's salary is harmless given that husband's income, I should say, given that his base salary would still be sufficient to pay the original maintenance award.
That is one of the points that the district court makes. That has to do with compounded errors, though, because she uses the reduced budget to come to that conclusion. If she treated the parties' budgets the same, which I believe the district court is required to do, I think that's a significant abuse of discretion in this case, that she refused to reduce wife's budget, but she accepted husband's reduced budget. He only came to the court and said, under the Saverin case,
what was his
if I have
budget?
To tighten my belt.
I mean, I think if I looked at the facts right, the let's say $230,000 in the new job, divide by 12, that's not quite 20. 20 times 12 would be 24. It's, let's say, 19. Even if you had a budget of $11,000, you'd still have a sufficient amount there in the base salary alone to cover the original $7,900 maintenance award. And I don't think his proposed new budget would be increasing to $11,000.
The cash flow, his proposed new budget was, I believe, a 17% reduction from what it was at the time of the judgment and decree. And our expert provided cash flow that is not in agreement. And I'm not an accountant, so...
But it's more the cash flow analysis that gets you to that point as opposed to just looking at the sheer absolute numbers. Okay.
Yep.
Thank you.
And counsel, did you want to make one more
If I
quick
may,
statement?
Just very briefly, Your Honor. This is a case where where Mr. Honke's salary was decreased by 15% after a completely unexpected involuntary termination from a long-term job. At the same time that his circumstances significantly deteriorated, Ms. Honke received well over $500,000 in tax-free gifts, which is important because if we translated that to the taxable spousal maintenance, the equivalent that she received was very significant. And yet the district court only reduced it dollar for dollar by her income change. Spousal maintenance is certainly intended to prevent a situation where one spouse's circumstances are significantly worse than the other. We don't want Ms. Honke to go on and have significantly worse circumstances than Mr. Honke. But this decision allows her to retain her significant gift income, and he is at a disadvantage because he has no way to save the kind of money and accumulate the kind of estate that she has. So when these two parties, absent a change in this decision, reach retirement age, he will be in a significantly worse position than she because of the spousal maintenance order, and that is not the intention of spousal maintenance, Your Honors. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you, counsel. Our thanks to both counsel. This matter was well briefed, well argued. It's complicated. We recognize that the issues are fully briefed, though, and appreciate that. So it's now submitted to this court for its decision. We will issue a written decision within the statutory time frame. Thank you. With that, this court is now in recess to consider its non-oral cases.